Arsenal for Democracy is available twice a week. There's a free episode at arsenalfordemocracy.com or Apple or Stitcher each weekend, and a midweek bonus episode at patreon.com/arsenalfordemocracy, available for $5 a month. The show is recorded and produced by me, Bill Humphrey, in Newton, Massachusetts. Our theme music is produced by Stunt Bird. Follow us on Facebook or at AFD Radio on Twitter. The show is not affiliated with any campaign committee, and each participant's opinions are their own.
This land is your land. This land is my land. California, New York Island, the Redwood Forest, Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy, episode 356, recorded on Sunday, March 7th, 2021. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me on the line from Idaho, as always, is Rachel. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, Bill.
And on the line from New York City is Kelly. Hi, Kelly.
Hello, Bill. Hi, Rachel.
On this episode of the show, we're talking about the rise of the music industry in terms of it being a literal industry and its typical adherence to the recurring patterns of big industrial consolidation that we've been discussing in all our episodes on the Second Industrial Revolution in the United States. Now, the history of the music industry does go way back to sort of pre-industrial history. Printing presses began putting out sheet music all the way back in 1465, and by the end of the 1400s, monopoly music printing was already a thing. But that was, of course, the sort of medieval monopoly where the crown or whatever your local government would give you the exclusive rights to print and distribute sheet music at the time. But that's still really not a mass-produced situation, and it's not the monopolies as we would understand them from the Second Industrial Revolution. Now, mass market sheet music exploded in the 19th century, and I think probably the big takeoff there has to do with something we've talked a lot about on previous episodes of this show, which was the new industrial cheap paper production processes that arrived in the mid-century. This form of industrialization of music and the introduction of industrial processes to music, of course, takes place before the rise of recorded sound. So we're going to be talking today about both the music industry as it existed in the sheet music era and then as it existed in the physical media recordings era. And we're not going to be talking as much, for obvious reasons of scope, about some of the more recent stuff in terms of digital music and things like that, because we're trying to focus in this episode on the early industrialization of music in the United States. So, Kelly, can you talk about Tin Pan Alley in the mid-1880s and how that influenced the so-called music industry in the United States?
Yeah, absolutely. And so one thing that really caught my sort of imagination about Tin Pan Alley is to imagine that in the mid-1880s, early 1900s, if there were a quote-unquote pop song, there was no way to tune into the radio, there was no way to go to the record store and buy a record. What you did was you went and you bought the sheet music for this popular song, and then you went home and played it for your friends and family. Or maybe you had a musical acquaintance who could play it for you. But the idea that there was still popular music in it at a time when not everybody could listen to it at the same time really caught my attention. And so this Tin Pan Alley, the term tin pan most likely refers to the sound of inexpensive pianos, which people said sounded sort of like tin cans. It was sort of a less refined, cheaper piano. And interestingly, if you trace the meaning of the word, tin pan at the beginning of the 1880s did mean an inexpensive piano. And by the beginning of the 1900s, just 20 years later, it meant the music industry. It was synonymous with the music industry, which just goes to show how influential this Tin Pan Alley was. And the Tin Pan Alley was a physical location in New York City between West 28th Street between 5th and 6th Avenues in the Flower District of Manhattan. And it really was one of the first hubs of American pop music. One of the reasons beyond this, beyond sort of the cheaper paper and the cheaper printing press that this Tin Pan Alley really came to be was actually the increase in copyright rules. People had to be more careful and more strict about copyright. And so for this reason, there really needed to become sort of a formalization of the sheet music industry. You couldn't have people just sort of writing the same song at 50 different print shops across the country. These copyright protections really caused this sort of centralization of the music industry. And so the songwriters, the composers, the lyricists, publishers, musicians themselves, they all had to figure out a way to work together within these new rules for mutual financial benefit. And so the way this worked is that songwriters would come to Tin Pan Alley to actually like purchase the rights to the sheet music that they would add lyrics to. Or if it was a famous songwriter, sometimes the company would actually like pay them to write the lyrics for it so that there would be more demand for this song. And what was really interesting, one of the things that was really interesting was that many of the sort of founders of Tin Pan Alley, which was established, considered to be established in 1885 and sort of last till the Great Depression, many of the most influential people there really had a business in sales, whether it was selling corsets or selling other things door to door. And so in addition to the sort of centralization and professionalization of this business as a result of the copy laws, sort of combine that with pretty aggressive sales techniques to get their product to market and widespread. One of the more interesting techniques for selling songs was something known as booming, and I'm going to read this from the Wikipedia article. It meant buying dozens of tickets for shows, infiltrating the audience, and then singing the song to be plugged. At Shapiro Bernstein, Lewis Bernstein recalled taking his plugging crew to cycle races at Madison Square Garden. They had 20,000 people there. We had a pianist and a singer with a large horn. We'd sing a song to them 30 times a night. They'd cheer and yell, and we kept pounding away at them. When people walked out, they'd be singing the song. They couldn't help it. And so I think this, even the current sort of radio market where songs get played over and over again, sort of like until you love them, that very much has roots here in this booming, as they called it, to sort of just take over a large event and get people hooked on their song. A couple sort of cultural notes that are important about Tin Pan Alley. One is that it is closely tied to the racist minstrel shows of the time. This is where a lot of the music was produced. Those shows, of course, are extremely racist, and it is impossible to separate the history and the economic success of Tin Pan Alley from those shows themselves. Interestingly, the industry also attracted many Jewish Eastern European immigrants, and one of those most famous immigrants was Irving Berlin, who many people still know today. As Tin Pan Alley continued to sort of increase their influence in the music sphere, they also became a real hub for entertainment in general. The New York Clipper was America's first newspaper dedicated solely to entertainment. So they covered music and arts and sports, and are sort of thought to have greatly increased the popularity of baseball in America. And so this is this also happened on this Tin Pan Alley, which I think just goes to show how central this location was for nearly 50 years in really a cultural hub for New York City and the whole United States. And then finally, a final note on sort of the model of the business and the way in which you will still see connections today is that Tin Pan Alley did form a professional association. And one of the things they tried to do was to lobby for longer copyright terms, which at the time were in increments of 14 years, and they wished to extend them to 20 years. And so it just goes to show you that this was not simply a matter of sort of people gathering to make and enjoy music, but really was a key stepping stone in the industrialization of music and sort of the consolidation of power and money and influence in music right there on Tin Pan Alley.
Yeah, I think that this Tin Pan Alley stuff is a good indicator of what was later to come in general in the music industry, right? You talked about the sort of racial exploitation. We obviously know that that continued for, you know, long after the decline of Tin Pan Alley and the sheet music, you know, with, you know, very bad deals to exploit black singers and jazz musicians and blues musicians and R&B and so forth all over the country and kind of, you know, getting a lot of inspiration for a lot of other stuff. And we also see the role in the copyright legislation lobbying and so forth. And they only got more powerful as things went on. They may have been, you know, had mixed success with that in the Tin Pan Alley era, but as they form, you know, alliances and partnerships and co-ownerships and so forth with the radio industry and the record industry later, and you know, all these different corporate entities, including they were, as you know, Rachel may allude to later, quite closely tied to the movie industry when that finally arose, and all of them sort of worked together along with, you know, book publishers and so forth, which is a topic for another day, to try to get those sort of copyright protections in place. I think also it's really interesting to think about, you know, as I said, one of the precursors for the industrial production and distribution of sheet music to take off is the physical material inputs that you need, being, you know, cheap enough, fast enough, etc. You got to be able to quickly print stuff. You know, the inks change, the paper changes, and so forth. That allows this to grow. But the other thing, of course, is that you need a consumer market for this. So there are class implications of sheet music, and I mean that in both directions, right? It doesn't just tell you about the society that existed based on who's buying it. It also tells you that the industry becomes possible in part because of trends and tendencies pre-existing already in that direction. We've talked, for example, on a recent episode about canned food goods and what a big feature of the Second Industrial Revolution that was, and sort of the rise of these urban middle classes and consumer advertising and things like that. And of course, we see with sheet music that you have to have leisure time and the resources to have a piano or other instruments. And in that, you know, late 19th century, early 20th century, when you have the sheet music publishers dominating the music industry before the rise of records, record players, the radio sets, things like that, those house concerts that Kelly talked about earlier, that was, you know, your middle class entertainment, right? You didn't have a radio set to sit around. You didn't have a TV set to sit around. So what were you doing? You were hanging out in your middle class home with your middle class piano, clattering away, singing, you know, with all your buddies and your family members, whatever the latest so-called pop song was that would have been sheet music at the time. We're going to talk in just a moment a bit about the phonograph side of the industry and the rise of that and how that kind of displaced the Tin Pan Alley model of pop production. But before we get to that, we need to talk about player pianos, which is sort of a kind of bridge between this era of increasingly popular middle-class sheet music, where everyone gathers around and does their own home concert, and before the era of having reproducible recorded sound, you have player pianos, which were owned by the rich as opposed to the middle classes, and they could automatically reproduce someone's music that had been, you know, as we would think of it, recorded, but rather than it reproducing it through, you know, acoustics or electronics, or even just electrical impulses, it was basically, you know, kind of like the early computers where you had hole punches and you'd program in things with hole punches. Similar setup, you had a hole punched paper piano rolls. These were an antebellum invention, but they weren't technologically advanced enough to be popularized or widely available to the wealthy until the mid-1870s. At the start of the 20th century, player piano producers became industry leaders in unprecedented consumer advertising campaigns, much as we've talked about canned goods and bicycles leading the way on that in previous episodes. A few years later, innovations in design destroyed most of the smaller production operations built that were building player pianos, thereby allowing the surviving larger producers to become an oligopoly, following the pattern we've seen across so many of the industries in our episodes. And it's also a point that Rachel's going to talk a lot about as we progress through this history today of the music industry in the United States, is that this repeated destruction of certain weaker early players, and then that redounding to the benefit of the survivors to become these giant titans of industry. That's a frequently, you know, recurring thing. Although obviously player pianos were always kind of a little bit niche, especially because they really were only producing for a pretty narrow wealthy audience, or upper middle class audience, I guess, you know, toward the end. In 1908, interestingly, the consolidated player piano makers, after this sort of destructive period, they held a conference to agree to industry standardization so that all paper piano rolls could play in any new player piano, thus benefiting all the manufacturers with growth. And that's a sort of interesting counterpoint as well, which we'll see repeated again with the record industry. You know, we've talked a lot about the role of copyright and these industries lobbying for copyright protections and so forth, but there were certain instances in which they realized that actually opening up some of the technology and making it easier to produce certain things would allow secondary companies to create demand for the physical devices, even if they were now competing for production of the things that were being played on them. In this case, piano rolls for player pianos. In the case of the record industry, you would it's again that distinction between record players versus the physical records that are being played on them. And this is how you build market share. And this requires a great degree of standardization. You'll recall in our episodes on Standard Oil, the reason Standard Oil was called Standard Oil, and that was really the pioneer corporation model that led the way on so much of this, was J.D. Rockefeller realizing that in order to make these enormous profits and have these giant industrial titans emerge, you had to have standardization, because the lack of standardization was the sort of key limiting factor, or one of the key limiting factors on the first industrial revolution. So we see here that even the player piano is a relatively small industry by comparison to some of the industries that we have talked about or will be talking about on this episode later. They saw the value as well in standardizing. By this point, around 1908 or a little bit before, the technology was also advanced enough to play back the notes identically to how it was recorded, allowing companies to market specific individuals' unique performances by name to consumers. That, of course, when you get to the actual recorded media side of things, becomes very important to the companies as well from a marketing standpoint. In 1916, word rolls were invented, which printed lyrics directly on the player piano paper so that people could sing along to the automatically playing music, kind of like modern karaoke. World War I further strengthened the powerful U.S. manufacturers of player pianos by ending competition with German companies. After the war, popular music supplanted classical music as the focus for U.S. player piano customers. But again, relatively niche compared to the rest of the industry, still an important digression I thought we should talk about. But let's talk a little bit more about phonography. We're talking about phonographs here, phonograph cylinders and phonograph records. So recorded music for sale, initially as phonograph cylinders and then phonograph records, began in the late 1880s, and the record industry quickly dominated the whole music industry. So phonograph cylinders and phonograph records originate from Edison's labs in the late 1870s. And for that, I'll go to Rachel to talk a little bit about that company.
Yeah. So Edison Records was one of the first, I guess, corporate actors in this recording industry, this nascent recording industry. So the wax entertainment cylinder debuted in 1889. This was mainly for arcades, saloons, etc., just like mass gathering places. And they were often phonographs that were operated by coin. Cylinders for home use came in 1895, and this was after more affordable phonographs were available for public use. Edison sold blank cylinders to Columbia Records, another major player that we'll talk about later, from 1889 to 1894, when one of his subsidiary companies, the North American Phonograph Company, dissolved. In 1902, Edison developed Edison Gold molded records. These are made of more durable hard black wax, So these cylinders could be played hundreds of times without wearing out. Prior to this, the materials were very soft, and you couldn't play them very much before the needle just completely destroyed them. In 1912, Edison introduced diamond disc records. These were the flat disc records that had just come out. They did have higher fidelity. Prior to this, the cylinders were very low quality, not low fidelity. So these diamond disc records did have higher fidelity, but both records and players were more expensive than their competitors. Also, Edison's discs and machines were incompatible with other producers' discs and machines. So this really cut down on their market share and just made them less attractive. This is kind of a counterpoint to the player piano industry standardization. In the 1910s, Edison was only the third top seller after Victor and Columbia, and this really caused their market share to shrink, and they never really regained from their losses, and they closed down in 1929. So while they were good at innovating the actual technology used for recording these durable discs, these durable materials for recording, they just weren't able to translate that success into the actual, like, selling of music aspect of the industry.
I also think it's interesting that they started with cylinders, similar processes inside some of those early player pianos, both of these things being sort of outgrowths of the post-medieval music boxes in, you know, from European clockmakers and so forth. But in the case of these Edison cylinders, phonograph cylinders, and then subsequently phonograph records, you're also trying to reproduce not only music mechanically, but actual recordings of the music and voices, which you can't do with a music box. Let's talk now, Kelly, about Graphophone Records, which were a competitor.
Yeah, absolutely. Technology, business, culture, this story has it all today. The Graphophone was developed by Bell's Volta Labs in the 1880s. It was certainly in direct response and in competition to the phonograph from Edison's labs. It was not hugely successful. However, one interesting piece of history on the Graphophone is that it was sort of gave birth to some of the first jukeboxes. As one of, and here, this is a snippet from PBS on their History of Music timeline. As one of 30 franchises competing in the Graphophone leasing business, the Columbia Phonograph Company achieves little success until it begins to record music to send to fairgrounds to accompany its leased Graphophones, thus resulting in the birth of nickel jukeboxes. The popularity of the fairground jukeboxes allows the Columbia Graphophone Company, and the company changed its name in 1894, to survive the dwindling economy of the 1890s and to become the only Graphophone leasing company to turn a profit. Though extremely popular, the first jukeboxes are limited by the impossibility of mass producing the bulky cylinders used in the Graphophone. Like the phonograph, the Graphophone has similar technical limitations in just the size of these, the sort of the replicability of these products to be able to produce them in mass. In business-wise, they are not particularly successful, except for this one idea of the nickel jukebox, which sort of catches on, and we certainly see later on in music history as well. And so shortly following the Graphophone is the Gramophone with an M, so Graphophone and Gramophone. The Gramophone really popularized the use of the flat spiraling records over the cylinders in the 1890s. And so similar like to in our lifetime with the you know, the tape in the CD and then the MP3 and all the ways we have to share music today, All of these companies and competitors were really looking for the best way to share high quality music in a way that was sort of manageable for people to carry about and to have multiple, you know, songs and music with them. And so really the size and the time that any of these one products could hold a song were really significant technical limitations that these companies all took different approaches to. And so when the Gramophone comes along, that has the huge advantage of being a flat disc, which is easier to reproduce, easier to carry around. And the mass production happened in factories after the initial recording was carved. So you could sort of do one initial carving of the song and then reproduce it many, many times.
Specifically using stamping machines, which you can't do with a cylinder.
Yes. And you can almost imagine just like physically how much easier it would be for a warehouse or any sort of distribution facility to distribute these flat discs rather than a cylinder. And how if you are the end user, it would be easier to have space to own multiple flat discs than cylinders. And of course, the stamping of the flat surface is significantly more possible than stamping on a cylinder. And the discs had more minutes of recording space than the early cylinders, although the cylinders did improve as well. Mr. Emil Berliner, who was the inventor of this product, he got someone to design a spring mechanism to rotate the discs at a stable speed for playback without requiring unreliable hand cranking. So now you could listen to your music without, you know, getting a sort of workout in cranking the machine yourself. The gramophone itself and Berliner struggled with endless legal battles in the U.S. and eventually left the market, but their flat disc technology was too successful not to continue. Companies like the Victor Talking Machine Company, which was founded in 1901, and the Victrola from 1906, ensured that the discs, now known as phonograph records, would take off. And their playback equipment, like the Victrola, was designed to look like stylish home furniture that you could have right in your living room. So while this was sort of an unsuccessful business venture for legal reasons, the technology really did shape the next steps of the music industry. Victor also significantly refined the actual recording technology in the mid-1920s to improve the sound quality of records and to compete with the increasingly popular home radio sets. This was achieved by shifting the recording process from a crude acoustical capture of direct sound waves onto the physical surface of the wax master recording disc before copying it, and instead using microphones and electrical impulses translated into precise physical outputs on the recording disc. The new machines for playing back the electric recording discs were sometimes more expensive than a car. Victor, which became RCA Victor in 1929, tried to devise and release a record that could hold more music in the 1930s, but the project was a failure due to the Great Depression's sharp limitation on people's ability to buy new playback equipment compared to a radio that could receive whatever was being broadcast. And so we see even from the phonograph to the graphophone to the gramophone, really significant changes in the technology that allowed people to record music, to mass produce that music, and then to enjoy that music in their home.
Now, as Kelly just said a few minutes ago, the technical limitations of the physical products are very important to understanding the development of the industry. And I think that's true for a lot of these things, but it's very easy to see sort of the physics impact on culture here. Early discs and cylinders could only store a couple minutes worth of music. Moreover, cheap early steel-tipped record player needles had to be changed after every side of a disc was played, until wartime rationing in World War I put more emphasis on using longer-lasting stylus materials. Disc improvements in the early 20th century could hold around 4 minutes on a side and were recorded on both sides for around 8 minutes of music on a disc. But until the long play LP records were invented in 1948, recorded music really couldn't be longer than that unless it had planned breaks to turn over or switch out the records, either by hand or eventually with a disc changer. The term album arose to describe the photo album-like collections of multiple discs of one song each sold together as a collection by a single artist. That term stuck around even after LP records allowed these collections to be contained on a single disc. The early albums, often bound like a book, held these 10-inch or 12-inch discs and could be stored on a home bookshelf. Radio stations sometimes used 16-inch discs to fit more on one disc. One thing we're not talking a whole lot about today, because it's not part of the music industry, is that there was a lot of stuff going on with just straight up voice recording, not for musical purposes, especially recording like advertising jingles and things like that, or just, you know, advertising pitches for broadcast on the radio. And those had kind of their own stuff a lot of the time in terms of the technology, because it didn't need to work for home use and fit in your living room. It needed to operate in a radio station studio. So they had a different sort of situation with their technology. Until World War II, most records were made of a compound of shellac, pulverized minerals, cotton fiber, and carbon black. The World War II rationing limited the availability of some of these materials for consumer goods, so the industry switched to plastic vinyl, which had already been in use for some records, especially the ones being mailed to radio stations. The vinyl records had more durability as physical objects, but often worse sound quality and lower replay durability than the shellac records, and they tended to wear out more easily or collect dust. Now, in 1948 and 1949, there was a long play versus 45s format war between Columbia and RCA Victor to develop and popularize new technology for home records with longer content. But before we talk about that, we should talk about who Columbia and RCA Victor were. We've talked a little bit about them in passing so far, but after Edison exited the scene in 1929, for a while, we had a kind of duopoly of these two power players, formerly Victor Talking Machine Company, which after 1929 was RCA Victor, and also Columbia, which was, we'll talk about, also had a different name previously. Rachel, do you want to talk a little bit about how those two companies had risen to their sort of commanding heights by the end of the 1940s?
So as we mentioned before, Columbia did use technology invented by Edison and also Victor to produce their records in their early years. So they purchased those cylinders, those blank cylinders from Edison. Columbia's big strength was the fact that they built up a strong catalog of artists. They were really focused on blues and jazz artists initially and kind of expanded as the decades went on. In 1937, they hired a talent scout, John Hammond, which really kind of had a huge influence on how record companies and the record industry interacted with artists. At that time, there was more scouting for talent and then really signing artists onto the record labels, which is something that Edison just didn't focus on as much. And so that's how Columbia was able to really expand and become the powerhouse that they did become. So John Hammond had a huge influence in the 50s and 60s post-World War II. He did serve in World War II, so he's out of commission for a while. He championed reissues of blues artists who were the direct influence for the emerging rock scene. So blues artists like Robert Johnson and Bessie Smith, who were those big influences on the rock artists that were starting to come out in the 60s. And one big thing about both Columbia and Victor is they pretty quickly started using acquisitions to build their power. So Victor was a really big one. And they started pretty early. So as mentioned before, they did innovate the recording technology. And in the 1920s, they started their expansion project. They owned controlling interests in the Gramophone Company in England, as well as the Deutsche Gramophone Company in Europe. And then Victor also formed the Victor Company of Japan, JVC, and that was founded in 1927. And then as RCA acquired Victor, the Gramophone Company in England became EMI, and that gave RCA a controlling interest in JVC, Columbia in the UK, and EMI. So they really kind of grabbed a lot of the market share very, very quickly. I don't know how much we want to touch on this, but kind of in the 80s, that's a big part of the mergers and acquisitions phase of the music industry. And RCA didn't really escape this. They were fully acquired by Bertelsmann, which is a German company, in 1986, and that made it a part of the Bertelsmann Music Group, or BMG. And then RCA Records under BMG became a part of Sony BMG Music Entertainment after Sony and BMG merged in 2004. And then Sony BMG dissolved, and Sony Music was restructured and became Sony Music Entertainment. So that's one of the big power players in music today. Columbia also in the 80s was acquired by Sony in 1988. So both these big major powerhouse companies were ultimately acquired later on in their lifespan. On the UK side of things, Decca was like one of the major record labels at that time. They were founded in 1929 and the US label was established in 1934. They also had a big part in recording technology development. Decca was actually named after a portable gramophone named the Decca Dulcifone that was made in the early 1920s before Decca was actually founded. This technology was ultimately purchased by the founder of Decca Records. During World War II, they developed full-frequency range recording, which was actually developed to record and catalog German submarines by their engine noises, which were unique to each submarine. And then this technology was later used to produce high-fidelity musical recordings. Another big thing that they did was they fully embraced stereo recording before their competitors, and they actually were putting out stereophonic records well before their competitors. So they were able to pretty much capture the stereo recording market before their competitors had a chance to. And then in the 70s, they developed digital recording and mastering, which is still being developed and used to this day. Decca is now owned by Universal Music Group, but the Decca name and label are still in use today. So Universal Music Group is another one of these big, major power players that are still extant today.
So we'll talk about that more in just a moment, but let's get back now to the 1948, 1949, and a couple years after that, format war between the long plays and the 45s, between Columbia and RCA Victor. And Decca is going to play a key role in that as well. So in 1948, Columbia announced a new type of disc called a long play or LP record, which would be played back less than half the rotational speed of the prevailing model of record and with a more precise stylus for narrower grooves, allowing more recorded audio to be crammed in on one disc. In 1949, RCA Victor released a competing new type of slow rotating disc called a 45 after its rotations per minute. And it's RCA Victor also released its own new type of playback machine as well. And this would similarly allow people to listen to much more music or voice content on a single vinyl disc, and which would and their player also had the advantage of automatically changing the discs at high speed so that the break between them would be almost inaudible. Early home 45 discs held 8 minutes per side, almost double the length of older discs, and would be further refined to eventually hold up to 15 minutes, while LP discs from Columbia held up to 22 minutes per side, at least eventually, which finally allowed entire albums to be released on both sides of a single disc. The two rival companies allowed other companies to use their new designs of records in an effort to gain market share for their proprietary record players. After 2 years, LPs had mostly prevailed within the industry thanks to Decca, that other big power player that Rachel just talked about, throwing their weight behind LPs. But both formats would continue to have commercial utility and appeal, so both companies would end up pressing records in both rival formats and manufactured record players that could play different records at different speeds, basically the old kind, the new LPs, and the new 45s, as well as occasionally a fourth type of disc, which we don't need to get into because it's usually for very specific usages. Even if LPs were more popular at home, 45s in particular had great industry appeal for use in those pop music jukeboxes that evolved out of the graphophone jukeboxes that Kelly talked about earlier. They only needed to hold one short song on a side, a single basically, and jukeboxes had already become a massive source of demand for records each year and a helpful source of listener data for the industry. So you can see that there was a huge demand for a while, at least, for both LPs and 45s, which helped incentivize them to come together and produce players that could deal with both kinds, even if LPs were, broadly speaking, the dominant mode after this format war. Home LP and 45 compatible players competed with older 78 record players. That's referring to 78 RPMs, but they weren't called that until this format war had emphasized the speed so much. They were competing with the older 78 record players from 1949 until the end of the 1950s in the U.S. and longer in other places. Consumers were gradually acquiring the new players over time, so they weren't necessarily phasing out 78s for, you know, right away. Jukeboxes themselves, even with those 45s, also started to decline from their peak over the 1950s as transistor radio sets became a competitor for people's interest. It's another way of, you know, hearing your own music. Even if you're not picking the specific single, you could at least, you know, listen to the radio station and what, you know, pop music music they were playing. The technology for longer records also continued to evolve over several decades to further improve length and quality, both in playback and in the recording process, and stereo technology arrived at the end of the 1950s. The recently established Recording Industry Association of America also in 1954 got the record technology companies to agree on a standardization of disc and player technology so that U.S. consumers could interchange discs freely across the player types without damaging their equipment or encountering playback problems. And there's some more technical information that I didn't want to get into because it starts to get into all kinds of like electric and acoustic science stuff that I don't really understand. But the point was that the RIAA pushed them to agree on standards again, much as we saw earlier with some of the other related sub-industries of the music industry. As Rachel said, and as Kelly said, there were other things that came along, obviously, and started to come along around this time, like tape recording as a competing audio format, and then there, you know, digital audio later. We're not going to get into that because we're trying to talk about the early music industry, and to the extent that we're even talking about the 1950s, we're really talking about outgrowths of the previous technology and iterations on the previous technology. But as Rachel has been explaining throughout this episode, the current situation in the music industry is a corporate oligopoly of the big three, as they're called. And the seeds for that were actually planted all the way back in 1929. I'm sure that the Great Depression probably had an effect on knocking out a bunch of the other sort of smaller competitors as well and allowing those consolidations to proceed even further. Most of these companies, or a bunch of these companies, preceded 1929, but their sort of big rise to power begins with their various mergers and acquisitions in 1929. It happened that a bunch of things all coincided around the same time, and it did take a while, both before and after 1929, for the record companies and device manufacturers to consolidate, but as Wikipedia put it very concisely, by the 2000s, a majority of the music market is controlled by three major corporate labels: the French-owned Universal Music Group, the Japanese-owned Sony Music Entertainment, and the U.S.-owned Warner Music Group. Labels outside these three major labels are referred to as independent labels or indies. The largest portion of the live music market for concerts and tours is controlled by Live Nation, the largest promoter and music venue owner. Live Nation is a former subsidiary of iHeartMedia Inc., which is the largest owner of radio stations in the United States. And if you're wondering, like I was, where iHeartMedia even emerged from, that was a previously Clear Channel. So as Rachel has already alluded to, Universal Music Group, UMG, is the descendant of Decca Records, which had acquired the Universal Movie Industry Company in 1952. Decca was founded in 1929. There's that key date. Sony Music is the descendant of Columbia Record Corporation, formerly the American Record Corporation, founded in 1929, and also now owns, as Rachel said, the remnants of RCA, the Radio Corporation of America, which had, before it acquired Victor, had been a project of General Electric, Westinghouse, and the AT&T Corporation, as well as the United Fruit Company, to end foreign control of American Marconi at the behest of the U.S. Navy for national security reasons after World War I. RCA's reorganization happened over 1919 and 1920, and then it acquired Victor Talking Machine Company in 1929, as mentioned earlier, therefore becoming RCA Victor. Now, Warner Music Group, which we haven't talked about yet, is the only original one of the old industry leaders that is still under a recognizable name, but it also came late to the game in 1958 as Warner Brothers Records to ensure in-house financial control of Warner Brothers Movie Stars musical side projects. Rachel, could you talk a little bit about Warner Music before we move on?
Yeah, so they were formed, like you said, to prevent Warner-contracted actors from recording for rival companies. This happened after a Paramount actor released a record under Dot Records, and Warner kind of saw that happening and wanted to prevent that. They weren't involved in those early technology wars that we mentioned earlier. Instead, they quickly became involved in the acquisition game. They bought out labels pretty early on in their tenure. One early major purchase was Atlantic Records in 1967. This included Stax Records, which had a very big, lucrative back catalog of soul singers, most notably like Aretha Franklin and other big soul artists. So they were able to use their like movie money to just kind of buy out all these record labels and just kind of expand their catalog of artists.
Now, one more thing before we move on to our final section. As we were preparing for this episode, we aren't going to obviously talk about Spotify because that's too far out of the scope of our episode, except to say briefly that I did try to explain to Kelly last week off the air about the Spotify ownership structure and payment structure as it relates to these big three industry companies. And I was not very successful in that. So I've typed it out very briefly. I'm just going to read it, and then you can all have this quagmire stuck in your head too. 10% of Universal Music Group is owned by Tencent Holdings. 1.6% of Warner Music Group is owned by Tencent Holdings. Tencent Music Entertainment Group is co-owned by Tencent Holdings and Spotify, as well as equity stake ownership by Sony Music Publishing, a division of Sony Music, and the owner of EMI Music Publishing, which Rachel mentioned earlier. Spotify profits flow to Tencent through their shared subsidiary, and royalties flow to Universal and Warner, which are part owned by Tencent, and also to Sony, which is invested in Tencent Music too. So there you have it. That's the structure of Spotify. As much as I could simplify it, just to point out what a complicated tangle these big three, which are nominally separate companies, have managed to find themselves in at this point. So final thing we have to talk about here on this music industry episode is Muzak. So listeners might recall our 2020 episode on the late 19th century utopian futurist novel Looking Backward, where one notable point was that in the early 21st century, you could walk into a music listening room and play any music on demand through a speaker system, much like people do today with their corporate voice recognition / surveillance devices. But what you might not know is that some of this listening room and on-demand music technology actually began to come into existence only a few decades after the novel was written. To understand the origins of that, we need to go to the origins of what is arguably the most industrialized music production of all under the brand name Muzak, although there are also various non-brand name competitors. So fascinatingly to me, this type of generic commercialized music that we might think of as department store music, sometimes referred to as elevator music, although Muzak never actually produced elevator music, this music does not derive originally from radio, as you might think, but rather from a separate technology for wired transmission of sound, including music, which was far more reliable initially than early radio technology. And again, I found this whole thing to be technologically very fascinating and a whole area of the early music industry that we haven't talked about at all yet. So Major General George Owen Squire developed a technology called multiplexing in 1910 for sending multiple signals over a single wire and then separating them out again at the end. This was originally meant to allow a single telephone wire to transmit multiple different telephone conversations simultaneously. But Squire kept playing around with it, and he realized that he could use it to transmit music on demand over telephone wires to home customers. Again, radio sets were coming into existence, but they were pretty new. They weren't that good. There weren't that many radio stations in the country, but a lot of people had telephones at this point. So a major utility holding company, which, you know, had lots of telephone customers, set up a subsidiary in 1922 called Wired Radio Inc., which was dedicated solely to this venture of providing on-demand music over telephone wires to their home customers. They acquired all of Squire's patents, and they brought him on board to keep working on it. However, as home consumer wireless radio technology became more viable, General Squire realized that he needed to pivot to a different use for the wired music technology, and in 1934, he shifted to enterprise customers, namely department stores. He also renamed the company to Muzak. Warner Brothers, which we've been talking about, then bought the Muzak corporate subsidiary from the utility holding company in 1937. So although the Warner Music side of things comes later at the end of the 1950s, they had had at least one division that was involved in music much earlier. It's just not the same kind of music that we would think of when we're talking about big three music. In the 1950s, Muzak began experimenting with designing music for workplaces rather than shopping spaces, with an emphasis on trying to pump up the workers to get more done. This was called stimulus progression, but many workplaces did not find this especially useful, and instead, well into the 1960s, they used Muzak speaker systems simply to kill boredom in places where people had to wait around for long stretches, like a waiting room, or probably even just to deaden the omnipresent sound of all the clicky-clacky typewriters that we just talked about in our recent bonus episode on dropped ceilings and mid-century office spaces. However, as rock and roll propelled a new generation of pop stars to individual or group stardom, the era of depersonalized and generic music was coming to a close. Remember, before this, up to this point, you know, yes, you would maybe have some classical or opera singers or whatever get their brand name on a record or something like that. But for a long time, you would just kind of have this sort of very genericized pop music that people knew the song, but they didn't necessarily know who it was written by or who was singing it. You know, everything was kind of owned and controlled by these oligopoly companies, and they, you know, didn't really want to have major stars or promote them in the way that they had been doing for the movie industry, but they gradually shifted to this model where they were intentionally trying to promote kind of brand identities around specific individuals or bands. And that meant that the demand for Muzak was basically going to decline. Companies that were willing to pay licensing fees for specific recognizable musical artists were able to outcompete the more generic Muzak. The company began to flounder, and they lost its longstanding focus by the end of the 1970s. And that is sort of the dawn of the era that resulted in grocery stores and some restaurants playing basically top 40 or genre-specific music. So that I thought was an interesting side detour, but again, one that, you know, closely relates the output to the technological inputs involved in the process. So I will go to you, Kelly, now for your sort of final wrap-up thoughts on this topic of the early industrialization of the music industry in the United States.
Yeah, I think there are so many pieces here that you could dig in and talk about for hours and hours, like any one individual piece of technology or moment in this industry. But I think it's equally important and interesting just to zoom out and see how this industry has progressed over the last 150 years or so, and see how many of the questions about copyright and distribution and ownership of this music really dates back to the time when printing sheet music was the primary way in which people got exposed to new music. So interesting to see history repeat itself time and time again in this industry.
Rachel, I want to get your thoughts.
I was talking before we started recording about how it would be helpful to have some sort of like flow chart or diagram, but I think it would just be actually more confusing and just kind of a big mess of spaghetti lines going from all these labels and companies. But I think it's really interesting how we're kind of stuck with these big three companies now, from what started as a proliferation of record companies and labels. And also, one thing you just mentioned that's very interesting to me is this kind of like rise of the pop star or rise of the rock star, because in the beginning, I think Edison actually just mainly put composer names on his cylinders and discs for labels, and the artist was almost kind of inconsequential, and how that's really changed over time with the rise of pop music and the rise of rock music, going away from more of that orchestral or big band music genres falling in popularity, and then rock music rising in popularity.
And I think that the reason we're talking about these companies and this industry is because of how it interconnects with everything else, right? All of these things ended up being, even if they were more complicated than some of the other industries we've talked about in terms of their tangled web of interconnections, they were all trying to do this vertical integration stuff that we've talked about in all these other second industrial revolution industries, right? Even to present day, you have the companies that are producing the physical devices for music playback owning these publishers, which own various labels, and the labels sign various artists, et cetera, right? It's just, it's all turtles all the way down. So it's important to understand this. And it's also important to understand how these current setups were outgrowths of physical processes and industrial processes of the late 19th century and early 20th century. And I just found this whole exercise to be fascinating. And it all started because I was listening to a podcast episode about the sort of weird setup of Spotify. And they kept talking about the music industry. And I was thinking, why is it called the music industry? You know, because these days there's so little of it that's industrial in nature, or at least relative to how much of it used to be this physical industrial process. And of course, it does go back to, as Kelly just said, that mass produced, cheap paper music for sheet music production and general distribution to the wider public. All right, Kelly, thank you so much for being on the show this week.
Thanks for having me.
And Rachel, thank you for being on as well.
Thanks. It's always a pleasure.